From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll look at the Biden administration's plan to help student borrowers and what more can still be done. Then we'll speak with the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute about breaking down current events through pop culture.
The most exciting part for me is when I find something out that blows my mind and sort of opens up like a trapdoor of knowledge that takes us to a deeper level of understanding.
We'll learn about some of the many events happening this month in Milwaukee. Plus, chat with actor Pepe Serna about the documentary on his 50-plus year career in Hollywood.
Our culture is so needed. See, no, we're not all the bad things that you hear and show. We have to create our own stories from our own family.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. The Biden administration recently announced a plan to forgive student loan debt for millions of borrowers. Student debt in Wisconsin totals $24 billion, according to a 2017 report from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So this announcement is a big deal for many Wisconsinites. But there are others who don't want to see this enacted. The Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty recently sued the Biden administration to put an end to this aid. Still, other Wisconsinites are looking for even more relief. Karen Bauer is an attorney for a consumer protection unit at the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. And Sylvie Eisen is a financial aid advisor at UW-Milwaukee. They're both former members of Governor Tony Evers' Student Task Force on Student Debt. They join Lake Effect's Mallory Chang to talk about how this will impact people in Wisconsin.
Federal student loans will be forgiven for millions and millions of student loan borrowers. And this is great news to those with student debt, me included. But how much student loan debt are Wisconsinites in, and why are so many of us in debt?
Higher education is expensive, right? And, you know, in Wisconsin, especially in our fantastic public universities, there's been a real push to try and get first-generation college students like I was to sign up for and attend college. But a lot of those families simply cannot afford to pay for the full cost of a two-year or a four-year degree. I'm sure that Sylvie is seeing something similar.
Absolutely. Certainly not to reiterate what Karen has already stated, but being a first-generation student myself and now working more so behind the scenes in financial aid, there is a constant narrative, as it has been for some time now, about pushing the need and worthwhile endeavor for having a college degree. And those, especially coming from low-income or first-generational backgrounds who may not have the ability or resources to navigate higher education, it can become something of a difficult track to pursue into that. So with that not being in sync and having that need, it can create this issue of needing to take out loans for school, which is already expensive, but driving this narrative for a need in having a degree. Otherwise, an individual may not be considered a worthwhile member in society.
Yeah, which is a really stressful thing to have that much debt at such a young age. And with Biden's student loan forgiveness announcement, Sylvie, I'm just curious too, because you work directly with students. How will Biden's announcement on student loan forgiveness specifically affect Wisconsinites with student debt? What will that look like?
I'll be honest, in terms of just the amount of traffic and the influx that has happened to our particular office on campus has exceeded, you know, an insurpassable amount. We've had just an influx of students contacting our office. I know I cannot speak for all types of financial aid offices, only the one I work in, where it's just students asking, what does this mean for me? You know, I saw this announcement. It sounds great, you know, for now, but what does that mean for me as a student? And we go through the process and we explain of what it means that if you were a Pell eligible student, you have the ability to get more than just 10 grand off, because students who as it currently states, students who are not Pell eligible may only be forgiven up to 10,000, while students who were Pell eligible could possibly get an additional 10. So we're looking at about 20 total, right? And kind of wrapping that up, there is a separate conversation happening as well. So in the UW system, there is something happening, at least with UW-Milwaukee, called the Wisconsin Tuition Promise, where we are having a pushback of students who are looking to enroll in fall 2023, which is supposedly when the initial start date of this is going to happen. So there are still behind the scenes work. By all means, this is information that has been relayed to me that I'm now speaking on, and by no means is anything definite, but it's almost like it's a pause for the inevitable. So yes, in the short term, it seems like a good idea. In the long term, as I have said, and I will continue to always say, we're not fixing the root of the issue. We're just covering it, and we're covering it, and there's Band-Aids, whatever colloquialism you want to use. You're not going to the heart and to the root of the issue, which didn't happen overnight. So in terms of Wisconsin students, it's about what can be done for me. Others are saying this seems like an okay deal for now, but not in the long term.
And Karen, I'm just wondering from your perspective as an attorney right now in the state of Wisconsin, the discharge of student loan debt is taxable income, apparently, according to the Wisconsin legislature. So many Wisconsinites might have to pay taxes for their federal student loan forgiveness money. What could this mean for those who qualify for forgiveness? Could you explain it a little bit for us?
Certainly. Wisconsin usually harmonizes our state tax laws with those of the Internal Revenue Code, the federal law. But they already did that for ARPA, the American Rescue Plan Act. They did that a few months ago before this was announced. What we're hearing right now is that it is not looking like the legislature in Wisconsin is going to reharmonize the provisions of this with the federal tax code, which will mean that people in Wisconsin will get taxed on their $10,000 or $20,000 forgiveness. It's problematic, especially since this exact same legislature decided that they did not want people to get taxed or businesses to be taxed on the forgiveness of PPP loans earlier on in the pandemic. I think that we have an issue where we're willing to tax our citizens, but we're not willing to tax our businesses. And I think a lot of people might have a problem with that. So in order for regular Wisconsin citizens to not be taxed, our Wisconsin legislature needs to act to harmonize Wisconsin state law with the federal tax code. And I'm hoping that anyone who feels strongly about this will let their state senators and representatives know that they don't want to be taxed. I think that's the only way forward here.
I do want to ask to both of you, because both of you did mention this, that this is great, but there needs to be ongoing long-term solutions. What are those other solutions that are needed so that Wisconsinites can feel relief from their debt, be protected in some way, and not feel burdened with this weight of student loan debt?
I feel very strongly about the need to further regulate for-profit colleges, and not only in Wisconsin, but in this country. A lot of the student loan debt that people have stems from colleges using very predatory methods in order to recruit students, constant TV commercials and giveaways and things of that nature. I think that our support for our flagship amazing state technical colleges and universities needs to increase back to the levels that it was previously. You know, that funding has been falling more and more and more over the past couple of decades. But certainly we need to address both things, right? The for-profit colleges and to reinstate some of that state funding for higher education.
I would definitely agree, as Karen mentioned. So anything predatory, it's simple enough to say, why does it exist? But I suppose that would be a different conversation and perhaps a longer one. But initially, my thinking, college needs to be affordable. I hear this day in and day out, whether you are going into a private nonprofit institution or if you're going to a public nonprofit institution, I am asked, and honestly, even recently, a couple of days ago, I was asked, why is housing so expensive? Why is tuition at a state university expensive? And then you have that conversation with those parents who are doing their best to help their child, the student entering into the higher education world. You have that generational progression of when I was in school 30, 40 years ago, I can absolutely see the progression of how higher education has changed. The amounts that I was paying as a parent at such and such time has definitely progressed, has gotten higher than in comparison to what it is now. And the question becomes, why? Why is school so expensive? And all of the affiliates, the educational related expenses that go along with higher education, how did we get here? Why did we get here? The fact that, again, that narrative of promoting you need a degree, otherwise you're considered worthless. Why? But yet it's expected of everyone to just pay these and contribute to the student loan debt, which is, of course, the 40 plus million now that we are now dealing with. It's this type of fundamental thinking of, again, this Band-Aid fix of we'll put this on, but you're still not addressing the core issue here. If not, it will continue to grow.
With this news, should Biden's federal student loan forgiveness be the end all be all? Should there be any other additional government intervention?
So to answer that question, Mallory, and I've said this before, this announcement cannot be an end all be all. Absolutely not. This is a slap on a wound when it needs healing. It needs deep healing. And again, this conversation is going to open up an entire can of worms, but it's going to require an extreme amount of work and strategy and effort to have this country dig, and the federal government and the Department of Education to dig itself out of the hole that it put its citizens into. This is, as I've said before, a step in the right direction. At least it's now acknowledging that there is an issue. It cannot be shoved under the rug anymore. It needs to be brought out and it needs to be dismantled, handled, strategized into a fair plan, something that works for the needs of everyone in this country, whatever they are, because it's not a one size fits all. It's not a one size be all, and it's not an end all be all. So to have that conversation where you're going to have to dig to the very root and core of this issue, it's going to explode and it's going to require an extreme amount of strategy, as I said, to really pull everything apart, see it for what it is, and start implementing a just and fair system for everyone.
As I have been thinking about how much this money is going to help some people and how little it's going to help others, one thing is clear to me. At the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level, any politician or leader who wants to get elected in the United States or in Wisconsin is going to need to include student loan debt and higher education in their platform. It's no longer going to be acceptable to anyone who owes student loans or to parents or to students to have this can get kicked down the road again. President Biden has taken action and the Department of Education is doing a great job of starting to address these issues, but we need all hands on deck. It's go time. And I think that we want to, I think most students, most people who owe student loan debt, most advocates all want to see action at not only the federal level, but the state level and the local level as well. The one thing that I really want to emphasize to all of your listeners is that our conversation today is not going to be all of the information that you need to access this forgiveness or to fully understand your options. Please go to studentaid.gov, G-O-V, to read about this extended payment pause and the forgiveness so that you know all of your options. And if you're not sure, reach out to your financial aid person from your school, or if you're in Milwaukee, in the city of Milwaukee or Milwaukee County, reach out to me and we can have a conversation about it. But you definitely want to make studentaid.gov your first stop in order to read more about this change.
Karen Bauer is an attorney for a consumer protection unit at the Legal Aid Society of Milwaukee. Sylvie Eisen is a financial aid advisor at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang last month. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? If you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also follow WUWM on Instagram, where you'll find videos and pictures from news stories and Lake Effect interviews. The Cine Latino Film Festival kicked off this week, and it's bringing some big stars to the area, including actor Pepe Serna. We'll learn more about his career and the documentary on his life later in the show. But first, we'll hear from Brittany Luce, the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The NPR staple show It's Been a Minute features people who create our culture, weekly news wrap-ups with journalists, and other interviews with special guests. For the past 5 years, Sam Sanders was the host of the show, but starting tomorrow, you'll be hearing a new voice, Brittany Luce. Luce is an award-winning journalist, on-air host, and cultural critic, best known for hosting the podcasts For Color Nerds and The Nod. NPR recently made the official announcement of Luce as the new host of It's Been a Minute. And ahead of her first episode, she joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski.
So It's Been a Minute has created a significant presence over the past 5 years, and it's always a bit of a tough thing to come into something that's has an established sound and feel. So what drew you to this show even before this new role for you, and what excited you the most about being a part of it?
Well, the thing that drew me to the show is just the breadth of everything that it covers. So I started listening to It's Been a Minute, like many other people, right when it came out, because I loved Sam's politics coverage on NPR. I'd already been an NPR listener for years. My original home station is WDET in the Detroit area, and I listen in to WNYC up here in New York. But yeah, so I'd already just been listening to NPR for a super long time, and I loved Sam's coverage. So I was excited to move with him to It's Been a Minute once that show started. But what I liked is just it was always at the intersection of where culture met news and current events and politics. Now, what actually, it's funny, the thing that you mentioned, coming into something already established and trying to figure out, you know, how to connect to the audience and integrate with the team, that those were actually the things that excited me the most about this role. I have spent like the entirety of my career outside of public radio. So that was also a new challenge that I wanted to take on. And I also had not done terrestrial radio, you know, like I have been doing podcasting for the past 8 years, and I've hosted so many different types of shows and worked with so many different types of organizations and expanded out to do producing and editing and culture writing and things like that. But I still hadn't had that public radio experience that so many of my peers have had. So that was something that was definitely appealing as well. But yeah, I mean, I have been pitching and hosting and producing mostly my own projects for the past 8 years. And so I wanted to have, I thought it would be a really fun challenge to try to take a show that already had a strong identity and see how I could make it my own, or see how I could reshape it into something new. So literally that is the thing that drew me to all of this. And so once I knew that I was ready to make a change in my career, because I've been doing a lot of freelancing and still hosting For Colored Nerds, my independent race, news, and pop culture podcast that I co-host with a friend from college, I knew that I wanted to try something different. I did not realize that It's Been a Minute still hadn't found a host. You know, I when that role first became available, I was so knee deep in so much other work. It hadn't occurred to me to even think about applying for that or reaching out about that. So yeah, I mean, funnily enough, once I realized exactly what I wanted, wrote it all down, put it on a post-it note that's still on my desk right now next to me, I was approached about this role at hosting It's Been a Minute. And it was like, it just felt like a perfect match. I mean, I still had to apply and do many rounds of interviews and record a test episode and, you know, write essay, like, you know, respond to essay questions. Like, it felt like I was applying to college all over again. Honestly, it was, they were thorough. But yeah, I was just, the timing ended up working out perfectly.
What you mentioned about kind of being outside of NPR and doing mostly freelance, your own podcasting, not being as familiar with that format or what you're diving into, I can kind of see that as being a strength, though, especially when you're taking something over. Because are you able to separate, like, I'm sure there's weighted expectations, perhaps from listeners who are waiting to see what you're going to do with the new show, having gotten used to Sam's style and voice and that formatting. But how much of that did you like and want to carry over? And how much are you just enjoying the freedom to say, we're doing something, we're trying something new?
I mean, I'm primarily excited to be trying something new. I think that there's a core of the show that that Sam and the team that he worked with, like, built, that is the thing that really attracts listeners to the show, which is just how much they felt like they can trust It's Been a Minute to help them navigate sort of like our ever-changing, constantly on fire cultural landscape. That core is something that I definitely want to remain undisturbed. But I'm mostly really excited to be able to just try something new and do something new. I mean, I've been working in audio for 8 years, and in that time, this will be the seventh, I think, time I'll be launching a podcast. And so, like, I, to your point, I am really grateful that I've had all those different kinds of experiences. Not many people who are in my position can say that that's something that they've had the opportunity to do. And also, I mean, because, like, and also to be welcomed back so many times. So I'm really grateful that I've had all those experiences where I did have to sort of bootstrap it, think on the fly, and just try to improvise and make things work and make things happen, because I think that that's a really big positive to bring to a show like this one. But yeah, I mean, I want to respect the foundation, but I am also just really excited because throughout the 5-year run of the show, and also throughout the fantastic run of guest hosts that they've had in the intervening time, the show has just remained consistently inventive, and I want to keep that going.
As you mentioned, your previous podcast, which is still running for a little bit, for Colored Nerds, you've gotten to explore Black culture through so many different perspectives for about 8 years of that. And as you said, you've grown as a host, as a creative, you have so many skills as you've done the freelance hustle. But one commonality between For Colored Nerds and It's Been a Minute is the pop culture lens. So what's the best part of breaking down what's happening, not just in the news, but what people are talking about through the lens of pop culture?
That's such a good question. Thank you so much for asking me that. Nobody has ever asked me that. That's such a good question. The most exciting part for me is when I find something out that blows my mind and sort of opens up like a trap door of knowledge that takes us to a deeper level of understanding about something. I love that moment because I know that once we introduce it to the listener through conversation or through reporting or whatever, once that trapdoor opens for the listener, then that's where sort of like the deeper questions come in. Like I just love those moments during the research phase, or even in interview, talking to a guest, when they say something or share a piece of information that's just like, oh my gosh, this thing that I thought was one way is completely different. Or more frequently, this thing that I thought was just a movie or just a cartoon character or just, you know, this like song that we all grew up listening to actually has deeper roots, but also much more significance than I initially thought. That sort of Trojan horse moment as the thing that I live for.
With this new role, you have a team. You're not doing all the things, as I imagine you were doing with your many podcasts and your writing gigs and all of this stuff. So as you turn to focus only on one job, do you find you have to remind yourself that you don't have to do all the things? Is it easy to delegate?
That's also a really good question. That is something I think that showed up in my 360 review maybe 3 jobs ago. Yes, I am trying to. But I mean, the team that we have now, and It's Been a Minute, everybody's so skilled and they're so smart. And also, too, the other thing is they know more about the show than I do. I'm joining them. And so it's really been fun to see how their minds work and where they're coming from. But I kind of have to delegate. I kind of have to trust because I am learning the show as I'm making the show. So, I mean, I think that, you know, we're going to come out of the gate really strong, but I'm really excited personally to see how the show is sounding in 6 months, 9 months, a year from now, you know, once we've really got into a place where we're really cooking with gas, and then, you know, I'll be able to see, I think, how much the show has changed, and to sort of like represent me and also the team that I'm working with now. But that's a really good question about delegating. It has not in the past been my strongest suit, but just coming into a new team has made me like just have to trust and on default. But they've been fantastic.
Well, and kind of along similar lines, a recent tweet of yours said, quote, "Wild how I avoided most of my homework for a smooth decade of school, only go into a career that I cherish and enjoy. That's a form of never-ending homework." So at least it's enjoyable homework, right?
Yes, exactly. I found myself being like, I got two interviews. I have two interviews that I am conducting today right now. You and I are in an interview that you're conducting. I'm conducting two interviews today, two tomorrow, and one on Friday with a guest that requires a lot of research. I mean, they all require a lot of research, but this person specifically, a lot of research. And it's just funny because I'm like, taking notes and reading things and highlighting them and putting them into cohesive narrative. I'm like, I do this all the time and love it. Yeah. Like, what changed? Because it's like, I was saying to somebody earlier that like, I feel like, and I wonder if you feel this too, but interviewing is like a book report, like that's due all the time, just rolling book report deadlines. But like, instead of proving to your teacher that you like understand the material, you're really just trying to prove to the author instead
that you like the book.
Their time. Yeah. I'm like, oh, higher stakes homework. Why is that interesting? That's surprising. But yeah, I do enjoy it.
Good. Well, I'm really looking forward to hearing you on It's Been a Minute. And Brittany, I want to thank you so much for taking some time to speak with me today.
No, thank you. This was great. I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Brittany Luce is the new host of NPR's It's Been a Minute. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And you can hear Luce on It's Been a Minute starting this Saturday on WUWM. It's the start of a scary season here in Milwaukee. And as many of us put out our pumpkins and ghosts, we're looking at some events that celebrate the season and others that'll help out our community. Every month, we're joined by the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service to check out some of the many events happening here in Milwaukee. Sam Woods is a staff reporter for the news service, and he joins me now to share what's happening this month. Sam, thank you, as always, for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Good to be back.
So October is a big month in the city of Milwaukee. There is a lot to enjoy as the weather is getting a bit cooler and, in my opinion, a little nicer out.
Yeah, a little crispier.
A little crispier. The first event that we're going to look at is an annual, exhibit is probably what you would call it, at Latino Arts.
Yeah, so it's the Day of the Dead Ofrendas exhibit. And as you mentioned, it's an annual exhibit at Latino Arts. So Dia de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, for a little bit of background, is a holiday originating in Mexico, but it's also celebrated in other parts of Latin America and the United States. And it's a couple days to remember family and friends who have died. And a cultural piece of this remembrance, of this holiday, are ofrendas, which are altars made up of items that can include food and beverages, photos, memorabilia, just any kind of items related to the person that is being remembered. And so every year, Latino Arts Inc. puts on an exhibit of several ofrendas from artists and people in the Milwaukee community who choose to publicly display their ofrendas. And for those unfamiliar, the scene is kind of, you might be thinking like, the scene is kind of like a graveyard, which is not really quite it. Graveyards, at least I associate with kind of like cold gray stone. And these ofrendas really are full of life, and they have brightly colored flowers, pictures, memorabilia, to help you kind of get a sense of who these people were in life and their impact on Milwaukeeans today. And last year I attended this exhibit, and while there are opening receptions and events associated with the exhibit that I would recommend looking into, I would also consider going when there is no one else around, just to kind of experience the silence amongst so much, again, like brightly colored, intentional remembrance of the dead. It's a really beautiful piece of Milwaukee that deserves to be experienced. And this is not the only exhibit or event associated with Dia de los Muertos. So I would also recommend checking out MilwaukeeNNS.org closer to the end of the month for other ways to celebrate and experience this holiday. But this is a really good one. Latino Arts Inc., they do good work, and it's a really touching exhibit every year, and I'm sure this year will be no different.
For sure. Now, the next event that we're going to look at is a decidedly different style of event. It's also something that I've never heard of before.
Yeah, so Data Day, definitely different style, different vibe. Data You Can Use is an organization that helps local nonprofits collect data to inform their work. And for example, in the past, this group has helped compile reports on public safety in the Amani neighborhood, health outcomes in the central city, you know, things like how the city is meeting housing needs for people returning from prison, just all kinds of things that nonprofit might come looking for data to kind of inform their work on. Data You Can Use helps get that data for them. But each year, Data You Can Use holds its annual Data Day, which is essentially a kind of, think of it like a pitch competition for local nonprofits to make the case as to why they need certain data, why they are having challenges collecting it, and how having that data would inform their work if they were able to get it. And the winners of this pitch competition receive Data You Can Use as services in collecting that needed data. And this year's is live and in person. This first time they've done a live event in a couple of years. And I've only ever attended the online versions of the event, but I can say for sure that it's a good opportunity to check in on what's happening in the central city and kind of what questions are out there that are looking for answers, but also what organizations are doing to solve those problems. And of course, just an opportunity to support the good work that Data You Can Use does every day and every year.
As somebody who works in journalism, I certainly appreciate a good data set.
Yes. And this would, again, this is a good chance to check in, kind of like if you're the type of person, journalist or not, who likes to keep their ear on the ground and kind of know what's happening. This is a good event to check in on.
Now, the next event that we're going to look at, I think October is, you know, kind of chilling, scary month where a lot of us engage in these different activities that frighten us or attempt to. This next event, I'm not sure if it would actually maybe not frighten people, but it certainly engages in the kind of eerie supernatural world.
For sure. Yeah. So as you mentioned, October is this scary season and time for ghosts and paranormal and examining kind of spirits in other worlds, right? And so fans of the scary season will enjoy the Milwaukee Paracon, which is short for the Milwaukee Paranormal Conference. And it's kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's a one-day event for all things paranormal. It's hosted at Averno College on the south side. And the convention will have some guest speakers, it'll have panels, it'll have documentary screenings, some activities even related to paranormal investigation, UFOs, folklore, just all things eerie, all things strange, all things unexplainable. If you're into that stuff, and if you look forward to October for that kind of stuff every year, this is the place to be. This one I haven't been to, but I learned that it's been going on actually since 2015. And I think this might be the year that I see what's up. It really sounds interesting.
All right. So looking at something decidedly less scary. Well, I guess that depends on who you are. College can be scary.
Yeah. So the next one I was going to say is a HBCU fair at Vincent High School. And you're right. It's you know, not scary in the same way, but I don't know if you remember, for those of us who were in high school kind of staring down the barrel of college applications and ACT tests and all that, it can be its own kind of scary, right? For parents of high school children and high school children themselves, navigating the application and scholarship process can be daunting. But for those looking into HBCUs, and HBCU stands for Historically Black Colleges and Universities, Vincent High School up on the kind of far north side will be hosting an HBCU fair that aims to provide students and parents with information they need on HBCU options and how they can get help paying for them. As these schools, like most private schools, are often quite expensive, but it's called an HBCU fair and there's a lot of information on HBCU specifically, but there's also information, they said there will also be information on tribal colleges and trade schools and trade programs as well. So while it's called an HBCU fair, there's a lot more to it. And so I, again, encourage it to, you know, as the season for college applications and ACT tests comes around, if you're looking for more information on what's out there, this might be a good place to start.
For sure. And with that idea of information, this final event, it's actually a series of events, and we have a local department, a city department, that is really looking for information from you.
Yes. So that department is the Milwaukee Health Department, and they're currently drafting their five-year plan of sorts for 2023 through 2028, and they're looking for community input on what they should be focusing on this time. And so for over the next month, the department is holding four input sessions at locations all across the city, one of which is virtual, where you can help, Milwaukee residents can help set priorities for the next 5 years. And this can be anything. The Milwaukee Health Department covers a lot of stuff, right? So if things like replacing lead laterals means a lot to you, if things like combating COVID-19 and the flu are a priority for you, or chronic illnesses, diabetes, even reckless driving, if that's something that means something to you and you want the health department to be focusing on that for the next 5 years, this is a chance to kind of make your voice known. And again, I want to stress that this is going to be the department's stated official priorities over the next 5 years. I mean, 5 years ago was 2017, right? So that's a long time. And so while this might not be as fun as a paranormal conference or a pitch competition, what comes out of these meetings will affect outcomes in our city for years to come. So I'd again encourage you to get out there and have your voice heard if there's a topic that really means something to you and you want to see the city be focusing on it.
For sure. A great way to let the city know what's happening in your neighborhood. I think sometimes we take for granted that our experiences are universal. And there are so many ways that each of us can contribute to these larger discussions. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us once again and sharing so many of these events.
Absolutely. Love to do it.
Sam Woods is a staff reporter at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and he joins us every month to talk about some of the events happening in Milwaukee. Coming up, we'll learn about the life of Pepe Serna, his work in cinema, and the documentary about all of it. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Pepe Serna has been an actor in Hollywood for more than 50 years. Throughout his career, he's appeared in over 100 feature films and 300 television shows. He's worked on memorable films like Scarface and The Man from Reno. And he continues to work today. His latest role is in an Amazon TV series called With Love. The Cine Latino Film Festival will be showing the documentary about his life, called Pepe Serna, Life is Art. Lake Effect's Mallory Chang chats with Serna about the film.
So Pepe, you are no stranger to the world of movies and acting and Hollywood, and you started your acting career way back in the early 1970s. And you knew as a child from a very young age growing up in Corpus Christi, Texas, that you wanted to go into acting. As a young child, how did you know that this was the life path for you?
As a young child, there were a couple of instances. One is where I got dressed up in my sister's dress and just, I don't know what I did, but everybody was laughing. I have pictures of it that are both in my documentary and my upcoming memoir. And then also jumping up on my godfather's boxing ring across the street from where we lived and pretending to knock myself out sparring after everybody was done.
and everybody laughing, and then me doing it again, but then nobody laughed a second time. And I think I kind of learned my first lesson is that the joke works once. You got to bring something new every time. So, and my mother would take us to the Mexican movies. They were called the Golden Age of Cinema in Mexico. She would drag all those kids along with her. And so I was just fascinated and just knew that I enjoyed the attention I got from it.
As you got older, you moved to Hollywood and you became an improv actor. And that's the whole start of your career. Just looking at your IMDb page, it scrolls on and on and on with all of the films and shows that you've been in. And you've got to work on sets with actors like Al Pacino and Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep and even a young Jennifer Lopez. And you're still working today, even after all these years. And what motivates you to keep working in the industry after all this time?
It's just something that I just have to do, like just like breathing. It was a muscle memory that I started at 3 years of age, and everything I did was performance oriented. Unfortunately, it was the same thing in class. And it didn't go over so well because I didn't do so good in school because I was too busy entertaining the troops instead of paying attention to what the teachers were saying. And that's why I'm such a big proponent of education. And the other big factor is that my wife, we've been together 53 years, she's always with me. We've only been apart 20 days in 53 years, and she's always there to support me. And she was a great designer, decorator, and it's all for our house always. She didn't have a need to do it outside of the house. But how fortunate I am that my wife didn't need to go out and do it for the world to see. She just did it because that's her. She just has to do it. So when I met her my second day in Hollywood, I started learning how to appreciate and enjoy the beauty all around.
That's really beautiful. And I just want to say, too, your documentary about your life is called Pepe Serna, Life is Art. And in the documentary itself, you're able to see the beautiful home that you and your wife have been able to create together. And it's such a beautiful space. And of course, you're an artist as well, too. Outside of acting, you also are painting. And how do you continue to stay creative after all these years in Hollywood? What inspires you?
I think, you know, there for a while after my series with Jennifer Lopez, the two series, Second Chances and Hotel Malibu in 1993 and 1994, I kind of hit a roadblock there because I was 50 years old, and I thought I was going to just keep working like I had since I got here. I just worked nonstop, and I'm doing it every day. I think the question is, what keeps me going? And a big part of it is that my wife is constantly, we have to go for drives every day. She gets stir crazy, and we have to go, and she's got to see people moving in the streets and stuff. And we go to the barrios and to the neighborhoods that don't have that much because they create from nothing. And so everything is a constant voyeurism of life and of the plants and the trees. And you can see right now I'm sitting outside by my pool and I'm here in Palm Springs. I kind of believe that by creating and doing that, we're celebrating our ancestors who got us to where we are, and they're still with us like our guardian angels. I'm celebrating what I was given. You can see by the way I non-stop talking. And now I'll tell you, when I was my real name is Pablo Alfonso, but my brother couldn't say baby. He said Pepe. So being from Texas, it was Pepe. So I've always had more energy than anybody else because I've been reinforced my whole life by people calling out my name.
And I just want to talk about briefly too, Pepe, something that you mentioned at the beginning, where you continue to be so inspired by the younger generation. And I thought it was funny, you think everyone younger than you is the younger generation, but you're inspired to inspire the next generation of creatives, the next generation of Latino creatives and actors within the industry. And it's no secret that the Hollywood industry, the Hollywood scene, is not very representative of non-white audiences, but specifically within the Hispanic and Latino community. And your documentary will be featured in an upcoming film festival here in Milwaukee called Cine Latino, where they're presenting 15 films focused on Hispanic directed, written, and focused films. And I just want to ask, from your perspective as a Chicano actor throughout all these years, throughout your time in Hollywood, what was the industry like for you as a Chicano actor, and what does this mean now?
My first TV show was the Uncle Charlie St. John show in 1955. And I was bebopping to Rock Around the Clock, the first time I'd ever heard the song. Then in 1964 in Corpus Christi, Texas, where I'm from, I did my first feature film called Jacket of Blood and Gold, where I was a bullfighter. And so for me, yeah, I'm a Mexican-American, but I was born at the Corpus Christi Naval Base and in Corpus Christi during World War II. So how American can you get? I've always known that I was an American, and even though you have to, the discrimination that happens and the bullying of, you know, people from different races and all that. But somehow, because I was an actor, big part of me that they just didn't buy into it. They just saw the idiocy of people looking at people by their gender or color. And so getting here and seeing that I was in constantly doing cholo parts, you know, the gangster, the always either killing somebody or being killed. A lot of guys wouldn't do those parts anymore because they just got sick and tired of playing the same old stereotypical roles. But for me, I thought, well, I'll do that. Who better than me to be able to do that and give that character a little humanity, giving some colors that are different than what people see.
Yeah. And what does this mean now to you, seeing your documentary about your life and your career featured in the Cine Latino Film Festival?
See, it's an incredible thing what Marcus Theaters is doing and with Cine Latino, because they're showing the community that this is a big gift. And the people have to realize, hey, come out, because they're bringing out stars like myself and Edward James Olmos and Josefina Lopez, who wrote and produced Real Women Have Curves. And she's continued to do incredible. She has a theater in East Los Angeles that brings in new writers and new creative people. It's just amazing that they are doing this for the community. Our culture is so needed to see that, no, we're not all the bad things that you hear and shown. We have to create our own stories from our own families. For me, I have always been a proponent of Latinos because we were the disenfranchised, and those are the characters that I got to play. But because of the improv, I got to play all the characters. So I knew, I always said, hey, if we're not fighting to get Latinos on television, and if we're not at the same time fighting to get Native Americans and Asians, everybody along with us, then we're fighting the wrong fight. We just need to know that we're all alike. We're all different. The Salvadoreños, the Guatemaltecos, the Cubanos, the Dominicanos, it just goes on and on. Ecuadorian, you know, you can't leave one out. I mean, Marcus Theaters is putting on this incredible event go to the movie when you see that there's a movie coming out and find out what, even if you're not of that particular country, if it's, you know, something that's happening in New York or something that's happening in East LA or now in Portland or Texas, you know, it just doesn't stop. And I'm taking my documentary all these different places, and I can't wait to get to Milwaukee and come out. We're there in person, and we will take pictures with you. We are just anxious to meet our Latino friends and non-Latino friends, because we're all in this together, and let's come celebrate it. Anyway, I'll see you there. I can't wait to meet y'all.
Pepe Serna is an actor, known for his roles in Scarface, The Man from Reno, and The Jerk. He spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Pepe Serna, Life is Art, will be showing at the Marcus Theater's South Shore Cinema on Friday. Serna will be there making a special appearance for a Q&A. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers. Audrey Nowakowski and Mallory Chang join me in producing Lake Effect each week, with help from Kate Flynn and Chase Browning. Becky Mortensen is our executive producer. This week, we also heard from Susan Bentz, Mayon Silver, Emily Files, and Taryn Powell from the WUWM News Team. Jason Reavy is our studio engineer. Michelle Maternowski is our digital manager. Valeria Navarro-Viegas is our digital editor. Trapper Shep wrote our theme music. Thank you so much for joining us, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.